It's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters. Can't hear you, John.
Sorry, I was muted. Greetings.
Okay. Greetings yourself, you cretin.
Off to another smooth start here.
Smooth sailing on the Brewing Network.
Yeah.
We have no troubles mastering technology, and this is why we're such good brewers, is because
yes,
everything goes right for us. We make no mistakes, and you know, we don't learn from our mistakes. There you go.
We are very familiar with the seat of our pants. Yes.
And you know who else enjoys the seat of his pants?
Our good friend.
Yeah, John Blickman. He is one seat of his pants kind of guy. He's always, I wouldn't say caressing, but enjoying the seat of his pants.
has a firm hand on the seat of his pants.
Yeah. A very firm hand. Yes. I would describe his caress as very firm. Very firm. I would also describe his knowledge of brewing and brewing equipment as very firm as well, and engineering.
Indeed.
Brilliant guy, creating a lot of amazing products for people to brew with, whether you are a home brewer, and even if you're a home brewer with a tighter budget, there's the Anvil Brewing products.
That's right.
If you are a home brewer with a little bit more of the green stuff to spend. There's a lot of the other Blickman engineering products. And then if you're somebody that wants to get into commercial brewing, or you believe that you can, sneak a commercial size brew plant into your house past the spouse, well, they have those too. All sorts of different sizes, ranging up, I think 5, 7 barrels, 10 barrels, whatever.
Yeah, turnkey systems ready to go.
Yeah. And if it's Blickman Engineering, it's good stuff. It's been designed to brew, not to just to sell. So check them out, blickmanengineering.com. If you get a chance, send a nice email to feedback@blickmanengineering.com. Tell John how much you appreciate that he pays for the show so you don't have to. Super nice guy, and I know he'd appreciate just hearing that you're enjoying the show. Let's see, what else has been going on? None of us have been traveling. Are you still traveling?
No, not at all. No, I've been stuck here for the last week or so, checking the fires on the fire map, see how close it is getting day by day.
We had clear blue skies today.
Nice.
I was stunned. It's no smoke. It's all, good Delta breeze comes in off the ocean and just clears everything out.
Yeah. We had clear skies a couple of days ago, but it's clouding up again, or I should say smoking up again, because they're getting fairly close, just a couple miles away.
Yeah. Well, and, I'm so missing getting a chance to go out to various countries and various states and visit and see people. Really missing that.
Yeah, all the really nice beer fests we went to last year, competitions, seeing all our friends overseas, and it is, we do miss that, definitely.
Right. Well, and you mentioned overseas and all the festivals over there. One of the big ones is Oktoberfest, which is going on right now.
That's right.
People don't understand that it starts in September.
That's right.
And it goes just like a week into October sometimes. It's really a September fest. And we did one here last year, and we had it in September, and people are like, oh, what a bunch of idiots. Don't you, this is Oktoberfest. You're supposed to have it in October. Don't you know anything? And we're like, well, yeah, we do know that Oktoberfest starts in September. You know, since it's Oktoberfest season, I thought maybe, you know, we could talk about Oktoberfest beers, because it's still one of those styles, although it's, you know, an older style, you know, it's a classic style. There's still a lot of people really enjoy good Oktoberfest beer.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely one of my favorites. In fact, I just picked up a six of Sierra Nevada Oktoberfest yesterday just to have a good quaffing beer while I'm outside grilling, you know.
We have purchased kegs of Eyinger. We got, I think, four kegs of their Oktoberfest, two kegs of their Doppelbock, two kegs of their Maibock, which is very, very rare. They made the once a year, and two kegs of their Dunkel. So we're going to have quite the Oktoberfest.
Dang.
my favorite breweries.
Yeah, yeah. Tough to drive up there.
Well, and so the rep from Eyinger was here, and I mentioned the story of the goat.
Oh, yeah.
It's been a long time since we talked about the goat. So on the bottle of every bottle of Salvatore. Eyinger Celebrator, their Doppelbock, there's a little goat, plastic goat, that's on a string around the neck of the bottle. And what you do is you take this goat and you put it on your mash tun, and it has magical properties that improve the quality of your beer. But you can't just go and steal one off a bottle at the BevMo. You have to buy the bottle of beer. You have to drink it in the presence of your brewery. Right. And then you put the goat on the mash tun. And thus, you get this special magical powers that improve the quality of your beer. I've been doing this is actually what took me from brewing just so beer to great beer and winning all these awards was the goat. It's nothing else, just the goat. And so I mentioned this to her. I told her the story about how there's a number of commercial breweries, even, and a ton of home brewers who have the goat hanging on their brewery. And she could say, you know, do you have one here? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You know, I wouldn't have a brewery without a goat, right? So I took her up on the brew platform, and there's the goat.
Nice.
And a friend of mine at True Symmetry, just down the road in Sassoon, he's got one on his brew plant as well. So there.
Well, it certainly served you well over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, now I've given up my secret. Everyone can now, take over, and I've lost my edge since I've shared the goat secret. But you can't just go take one. You actually have to drink the beer. You have to drink it while you're in the presence of your brew plant. You can sprinkle a little bit on the brew plant if you want, but that's the key there of the goat magic. So, and I heard that, rambling on stories, but I was told that the goat, they did that some years back because like the local town was, you know, suffering unemployment or whatever. It needed, you know, revenue coming in. And so they had these goats made in the local town and they started putting on the bottle. And then after a few years, they're just like, well, okay, we don't need to do this anymore. So they stopped, and then people freaked out that there was no goat on the bottle anymore. So they had to continue doing it. So there you go. It was something to help out the town, and now it's a permanent part of the bottle.
Part of the legacy. Yeah.
And they're just south of Munich, where the Oktoberfest is.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Close there in the little town of Eying. Where let's go back a little bit. What's kind of the history of Oktoberfest, John? Where did Oktoberfest start? Why?
Well, it started in 1810 with the marriage of the crown prince and princess, whose names I forget, though the princess's name was Teresa in English. Mm-hmm. And they had this wedding party and a horse race out on this meadow named after the princess. And everybody has such a good time. They said, we should do this again next year. So that was the start of the Oktoberfest festival towards the end of September. And it was for the wedding of the prince and princess. And of course they had snacks and they had beers, and the original Oktoberfest beer would have been a Munich Dunkel. That was the dominant beer style at the time. But now 1810, if you think about that in the context of brewing history, Pilsner beer was developed in 1842. Mm-hmm. And the story of Pilsner beer is a very interesting topic as well. But in terms of the Bavarian beers at the time, you had your Munich Dunkel, and you had a number of very famous brewers at the time, Gabriel Settlemeyer and Anton Dreher from Munich, and I forget where Dreher is from. Vienna. He was from Vienna. And they had gone to England in 1833 to learn more about how they were producing pale malt with using coke for firing their kilns, as opposed to the German methods, which were generally using wood. Now, the Germans use both direct fire and indirect fire to dry their malt. The direct fire, of course, with the smoke or so on, gave rise to the smoked malt, very mm-hmm. popular in Bamberg. And then they had indirect as well. Their standard Munich malt was a darker malt, somewhere in the between 10 and 20 Lovibond. Mm-hmm.
Which is great for making a Dunkel.
Yeah. 100% Munich malt, you've got a Dunkel. It's a very lovely, rich tasting beer.
Super malty, and it got a rich, rich amber color, almost brown to it.
Yeah. 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 A very deep amber mm-hmm. you get from the Munich malt. But they were very interested in these paler malts that the English were producing. And so they started using Moravian barley, and the maltster there was incorporated the lighter kilning regimen, and that's how Vienna malt was started being produced. Mm-hmm. And so both Sittemeyer and Dreher, I'm probably not pronouncing these right, my apologies, started using Vienna malt, and they both introduced Vienna style beers in 1841. Yes. And then a year later, Pilsner was introduced by the, mm-hmm. the Czech brewers. So over time, there was a transition at Oktoberfest from the Dunkel to these Vienna styles, and then a little stronger Märzen style, again brewed with a combination of the Munich and Vienna malts. Mm-hmm. And with the advent of the Pilsner malt at around the same time, you started getting variations. Now, interestingly enough, in 1872, the Franz Conner Liszt Brewery of Munich introduced their Oktoberfest beer, named Oktoberfest, as a golden yellow beer. And this beer is still brewed today as Spaten Oktoberfest. Mm-hmm. Hocker followed in 1893 with a Münchener Gold. And then Munich Helles debuted as a style in 1895. So there was this, you know, variety of beers now being served at Oktoberfest. You had the Dunkel, the Märzen, the Vienna, and these Oktoberfest or Helles, more Helles style beers. You know, of those four styles, one other interesting fact, if you look at Ron Pattinson's work, if you're familiar with Ron. He's a beer historian. He's reviewed a lot of the brewing records, and he's noticed that most of the German lager beers from the late 1800s on, you know, 1850 to 1900, were generally lower attenuated than beers today. Mm-hmm. And that attenuation averaged between 65 and 70% apparent attenuation, whereas today most beers are at 75 to 80% apparent attenuation. Mm-hmm. So there they be that difference too in terms of the character of the beer, right. You know, historic Oktoberfest to today's Oktoberfest.
Let's do this. Let's take a short break to hear from some of our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll have more about Oktoberfest and Märzens and all of that right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking Oktoberfest beers. Wesley wanted to know, does John Palmer even actually brew anymore or just talk about it?
I do brew, and I've brewed twice this past summer. I was just thinking to myself, I need to brew again as I'm looking at these nice Oktoberfest beers. I've got a sack of Maris Otter literally right behind me. It's right there next to my desk, just waiting to be used. I know that's not the right malt exactly for Oktoberfest, but it's what I've got available. And I've got some 3470 yeast available, so I'm ready.
There you go. It's just a matter of doing it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one thing about commercial brewing is, you know, you got to keep brewing. You got bills to pay and you got customers to feed. And there you go. Forces you to do it. Let's go back to you were talking about Ron Pattinson and the attenuation has improved. One of the things that people have talked about beers at Oktoberfest is that now, you know, they are selling, a much lighter, higher alcohol beer, or a thinner residual, I guess. So people can, consume. En masse,
The older styles, say 1850, 1875, generally around 6% ABV, and that has drifted downwards now to about 5 to 5.5% ABV. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the Bock and Double Bock, the Oktoberfest or the Märzen style was never as strong as the Bock's. It was more of a an afternoon, quaffing kind of beer. It wasn't the strong beer. It has dropped about 1% ABV over the last 100 years or so. But again, there's a real variety of beers that are served at Oktoberfest. So, there's never been a defined Oktoberfest style. I mean, outside of the homebrewing world where we're trying to nail it down. There's always been a range of anywhere from, 4.5, 5, 5.5, 6, 6.5%. you know, depending on whose beer you're talking about in particular.
Right, right. And Rich was asking, I'd love to hear your thoughts on Märzen's versus Maibock's versus Oktoberfest versus Fest beers. So, you know, Märzen versus Oktoberfest, I mean, to me, they're really the same beer. You know, yeah. I guess sometimes people say, well, you know, one's a little more amber, or a little more this or a little more that. I think essentially for me, it's the same beer. I guess traditionally they would brew these in March, and then they would, keep lagering them, and you know, they would sell whatever was the remainder of it would be used at Oktoberfest, right?
Right. Then, yeah, that was one origin story for the Märzen, and you know, like I said, there is the Dunkel and the Märzen styles were kind of side by side. Märzen being a little bit lighter, and you know, as you say, you know, they're finishing off the beer brewed in March in September to get ready for the new brewing season. So hey, let's have a party. Let's take all this beer to the Oktoberfest, and we can drink it there. So that's one reason that style of beer became associated mm-hmm. with Oktoberfest. Mm-hmm. But it's also important to understand that the Helles style, Munich Helles, was very much associated with Oktoberfest, say from 1890 on. Mm-hmm. You know, these pale lagers. In fact, there was a one of the meetings of the Brewers Association of Munich. Several breweries got together and tried to propose and pass an edict preventing the manufacture of pale beers because they felt it was cutting too much into their Dunkel business. But the brewers of the pale beer, the Spaten Brewery and what was the other one? Anyway, they said, no, it was the Shore Brewery. We're making this. We're, you know, the customers want it. We're going to keep brewing it. So, you know, there was a gradual transition in Oktoberfest beers from the darker and heavier styles like Dunkel and Märzen to the lighter styles such as Helles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you think that it was, you know, people's drinkers' preference that drove this, or was it cost savings, or was it, you know, the newer technology came in to allow for a paler beer, but is that what people were, you know, desiring at the time, or
yeah, I think that's a good question. I think you really have to just pin it to, you know, constant human nature. I mean, hey, what's new? What's new that people are drinking? So mm-hmm. pale beers at the time were new. People wanted to try them. Just like the NIPAs today, you know, hey, we've got these new flavors, we're brewing them. You know, the traditionalists are saying that's not IPA. And like, no, it's not. It's New England IPA. It's this hazy IPA kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, back then they had their traditional beers, and then they had these new pale beers that customers were asking for. Mm-hmm.
Also because of the invention of glass, or, you know, inexpensive glass containers right. that you could see through. Right. And all of a sudden, you know, the appearance of beer became a big deal where, you know, if it was brown and murky, it didn't matter before because you didn't really see it. You just tasted it. Yeah. And then it became a big thing once glass was in use more popularly. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. This turn of the 20th century was, it was a very hip time. I mean, we had glass, we had science, we had the Industrial Revolution in full swing. This was perceived as a very modern age by people. So, yeah, they were looking for what's new. And at the same time, Pilsner beer was very popular in the United States. And I'm doing a project for the MBAA with Greg Casey, formerly of Miller Coors. And he's writing a history on the history of American lager, American light lager. And it's amazing to understand the impact that American lager brewing was having on Europe, because we were brewing adjunct lager and we were achieving clearer beers than what the Europeans were typically achieving. So in many cases, they were learning, from us as well as us from them. Very dynamic time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I wonder, the consumer is always looking for, I think the majority of consumers are always looking for something, relatively light and refreshing to drink.
Yep.
And they want alcohol. And so, it's no coincidence that, the majority of the beer consumed is, very light flavored beer, with very little flavor, and, it's just an alcohol delivery thing, and it's quite refreshing.
Yeah. Tastes great. Less filling.
All right. That's why, seltzers and things like this have become popular, because, there's really nothing to them, and, they're very light, and it's just a delivery for alcohol. I think there's always some group of people, like you and I and the rest of the homebrewers who want, flavor and richness and history and all that. Talking about flavor and richness, and Rich was asking us about Maibock and Märzen's and Maibock, so a lot of these beers are brewed in the fall. They lager throughout the winter, and then they're tapped in May for Maibock, right?
Yeah.
And it tends to be a much lighter color Bock beer than the Doppelbock, and, much paler. And then, the Doppelbock itself tends to be released when? When is a Doppelbock released traditionally?
I don't know.
Now they're brewing them around year round.
Oh yeah,
technology.
I think the Doppelbock, if I remember, the Polliner monks brewed it for Lent, to consume during Lent. So that would mean that they were probably brewing it, say, in October, and then drinking it in the spring or in March.
Then, with the desire for a lighter color beers again, the Maibock probably, came up after that once they had the lighter beer technology.
Yeah.
The kilning of the malts. And it's interesting that both survived. If you look at, Dunkel beer has survived too, but just barely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just doesn't sell nearly as much. It's interesting that it hung on versus a lot of these other beers. Let's see here. Couple of questions about the brewing. Let's do this. Let's do another short break. And when we come back, we will get into, a recipe for brewing an Oktoberfest beer and some of the techniques. We'll be back right after this.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking Oktoberfest beers. And what's a typical Oktoberfest recipe? What would you recommend for? And again, I guess you have to kind of identify this is more classic. This is, more today.
I think if you're going for more of a classic interpretation of the more of the amber Oktoberfest, more of the Märzen and end of it. You'd be looking first off at a gravity of around 1055 to 1060 is pretty typical, somewhere in there. Usually one to two gravity units to bitterness units. That is, it's 30 IBUs, for example, for a 60, a 1060 OG. Somewhere, you know, so 25 to 30 IBUs for this style is typical. Next, you know, if you're going for the Meritzen style, you'd be using a larger proportion of the Vienna malt, followed by a little bit of Munich for some extra punch, and a good percentage of Pilsner malt to balance it out. And then depending on how rich and sweet you wanted that beer to be, you would add, say, 5% of like a Kara Munich to give it a little bit more color and a little bit more residual sweetness. So in my mind, a typical recipe for these amber Meritzens would be something like 60% Vienna, 25% Pils, 10% Munich, and like 5% of the Kara Munich. Then your hop bill would be mostly bittering additions. So again, you're looking for 25 to 30 IBUs total. I would put most of those IBUs into the bittering dose, and then just a touch into at the end of the boil if you want some hop aroma or a little more hop character in the beer. But generally, these are very malt-focused beers. And then a lager yeast such as the 3470 strain or Bavarian lager, something like that.
All right. Let's see. What do we do here at Heretic the last time we brewed this? We went with our silo malt, which is RAR Alex. We did 42%-ish. We did Weyermann Vienna. That was about 22.5%. And Weyermann Munich, about 28%.
Okay.
And then Weyermann Kara Munich 3, we used about 7%.
Okay. So you had kind of like a third, a third, a third almost. Uh-huh. Ratio of those three base malts. Yeah,
not quite, but
yeah,
we dialed it down a little bit from there. And let's see, starting gravity 13.5 P, Plato,
about 1054.
Sounds about right. Finishing gravity 3.2 Plato.
Okay.
So, an alcohol by volume about 5.7 is right in that range. Hopping Halotau tradition at 6.8% alpha acid. This was the 2016 crop. We used 6.8 kilograms at 60 minutes and 1.4 kilos at Whirlpool, and this was for 38 barrel ish, 38.7 barrels of Oktoberfest. And we ferment with the 830 yeast,
okay,
the German lager yeast, because we use it for other beers. I always enjoyed using like the Eyinger strain and, you know, some of the other, you know, the South German lager and some of those other ones. The only ones I think you can't use are something like the Mexican lager or the American lager yeast.
Right.
You know, most of the ones that are identified as German work well in these styles. Some will express more maltiness. Some will express a little more dryness or acidity or more hops. You know, so it's just, it's nice to try them all.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Now, if we're going to brew that more to the Hellas side of things, then I think you could, you know, back off on the Vienna Munich in favor of Pilsner malt, move some percentages around, and you know, you could take your beer color from say 5 or 8 SRM down to 3 to 5 SRM, make a little bit more golden than say amber.
Or you could, you know, intensify the color and go up.
And, yeah, that's true too.
Get more towards there. And let's see here. Josh asked, is there any reason to Whirlpool Oktoberfest beers? I typically Whirlpool hop heavy beers like IPA instead of the more malty German beers.
Well, I guess what he's asking is if, you know, you're not Whirlpooling them to do hop additions, or separate Trub, like in a commercial
break. For the break material.
Yeah, that's why you Whirlpool is before it goes in the heat exchanger. But yeah, you're not really doing Whirlpool hop additions for this style. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't. I would, you know, filter and chill like you normally would. But not really. Maybe you could do one hop addition just for a touch of, you know, noble hop aroma or something like that. But otherwise, it's not exactly the style.
Yeah, we do a tiny bit of Whirlpool hopping, really just because we like to lager it quite a long time. And the lagering time, that hop note tends to settle out into just a kind of a subtle background hoppiness. When we just added it in the boil, it was, you know, really wasn't present. And, you know, we want just a faint kind of, you know, note of, yes, there are hops in there.
Yeah.
You know,
you're a craft brewer. We're doing this because we like hops and beer.
Right. Yeah. But, we Whirlpool it. I would always Whirlpool any beer. Especially if you get, you know, substantial break material. You don't have to. I mean, you can just let the break material settle to the bottom and then, you know, draw off. But, you know, if you Whirlpool, you can get a, you know, a little pile in the cone in the middle. And I guess it depends on your tools that you're using to draw off the wort. And if you've got a way of drawing it off and not pulling a whole bunch of the Trub along with it, and then, yeah, I guess there's no reason to Whirlpool at that point.
Yeah, if you have one of the Anvil kettle strainers, which are made from a stainless steel braid, they do a great job of separating your Trub and hops from the going into the fermenter.
There you go, a little product placement for you there, Joe. Leaf is asking, hello, do you still recommend the tasty method for lagers? I keep saying it's the Narcissus. It's the modified Narcissus way of brewing. But we can call it the tasty method as well. Can you tell how to practice the fermentation process when final gravity is reached? Do you leave it in the fermenter a week extra, or do you package after a day high temp rest? So the whole concept, through reading and trying different stuff, when I was homebrewing, I came across this process of starting colder in order to minimize development of some of the precursors of some of the fermentation byproducts you don't want in a lager. So starting a little bit colder. And here at Heretic, we do, generally 40, 45-ish. Let's see where this one started at. Let's see, initial temp. Yeah, I don't see it on this one. So we would start at 44 to 47 is kind of where we like to pitch. It just depends on water temperature and things like that. And we will pitch our yeast. We'll remove any sort of fermentation temperature control up to 50, or we'll like reset our controls to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So you pitch the yeast in, and within, you know, a day, usually as the yeast growth happens and it's just getting started, it will bump itself up to 50. So then it's at 50. We will control it at 50 for a couple of days, you know, a day or two, and then we start removing the temperature control, and we'll let it rise, you know, a couple of degrees a day, two to 3 degrees per day. And by the end of a week, it's pretty much done at that point. So fermentation takes about a week. And at that point, you're running around, you know, 64 degrees or so. We'll take the last of the fermentation control off. It may rise another degree or so. And then we'll let it set for a day or two while we check for BDKs, acetaldehyde, things like that. And we do that in our lab. We can do it, you know, sensory. You know, once we can't taste it ourselves, then we, you know, double check in the lab. But 99 times out of 100, by doing this properly with the proper pitch of yeast and the proper temperature control, you end up with beer after 7 days that is fully attenuated and does not have these off flavors in them. And so that's kind of a narcissist thing. You know, people talk about doing a diacetyl rest at the end by raising temperature. And what I'm saying is you don't necessarily want, you could do a static fermentation temperature and then just raise it at the end, which is kind of difficult in a commercial setting. And it's difficult for some homebrewers because they don't have heating, right? You got chilling to do your lagers, but then you need heating as well. Because, you know, once it's done fermenting, nothing's really going to drive the temperature up unless you've got like a hot garage or something. And with the fermenters we have, there's no way of heating them. So you really need to plan to get your fermentation temperature up in heat. So by doing this, a couple of things are happening. You're restricting some of that early growth and development of some of these compound precursor compounds for VDKs and what have you. And so you're increasing the activity of the yeast as you go over time. And so that the yeast keep working and do attenuate more. And at the end, will start taking up some of these compounds that are there. And so it's a very quick, easy way to make lagers. Now, we still like the lager. And one of the important things that I didn't realize early on in brewing, but I realized later on that in lowering the temperature of the yeast, there is a reason for lowering it very slowly. So we will do 3 degrees Fahrenheit in the morning, and then we'll make a 3 degrees Fahrenheit change in the evening before we leave. So every 24 hours, you're dropping up to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we take it down from the existing temperature down to, you know, below, you know, 40, and then we're good. If you wanted to lager it with yeast activity, you'll also slowly bring it down, but you won't go below 40. Maybe you go to 45 or, you know, 50, and you're lager at that temperature if you want the yeast activity still to be there. If you go below 40, there's really no yeast activity. So we drop it down, and then we let it sit, and then we'll package after that. But this may not work for some people because you need to have a good, sizable, healthy pitch ready to go. And, you know, then you can pitch at these lower temperatures and then you can let it rise. If you are limited in your pitch, you know, you may just get a really slow ferment, not a very active ferment. If that case, if you see that happening, raise the temperature on it. you know, start bumping the temperature up, go up a few degrees, get up to, you know, 55, you know, 57, let the thing, you know, go, because you'll just end up with a partially attenuated beer, which will be even worse.
Yeah. Let me comment a bit on that. There was a really good lager workshop this past week at the World Brewing Congress, which is virtual these days. Ashley Carter of Bierstadt talked about her lagering method, her lager brewing method, and as well as Dasan from Live Oak and Florian Kupland from Urban Chestnut. And it was interesting in the workshop because each of them had their own methodology, you know, their own standard practice, just like you've discussed, Jamil, for doing their lagers. Florin used the modified Narcisse in general, with his, you know, temperatures and so on, and his yeast strain. Ashley has her own house yeast strain, and she prefers to do a very long, cold fermentation. So, you know, she starts cool and keeps it very cool for a long period of time, about a 2-week primary fermentation, and then gradual decline in temperature, you know, down to about 40 degrees, holding it there for another 7 days before continuing down to like 32 for an extended longer time. And part of the, you know, the way she's able to do that is that she is pitching and repitching her yeast. She has trained her yeast to work with that regimen, and she has trained her palate and, you know, to understand her beer, do the VDK tests and so on, and know when that beer and is ready at each stage of the process. So I guess what I'm trying to say, there's a lot of different ways to brew lager beer. But you have to understand what's happening from the yeast and beer point of view.
Yeah, I caution people against long, low temperature, slower fermentations in lagers, because the yeast will produce quite a bit of sulfur. And when you have these less active fermentations, they're slower fermentations, you tend to build up a much higher residual amount of sulfur in the beer. And then, you know, people are always asking, well, how do I get rid of the sulfur? You can bubble CO2 through it. But, you know, it, if you're going to do something like that, you just need to make sure you're fermenting vigorously enough, vigorously enough, that it blows off the sulfur. You need that expelling of gas to drive off the sulfur. Otherwise, it can get kind of out of hand. And did you say there was a third one that people were doing?
I guess Dasan was talking about his method, and it was kind of a blend of the two. He used I believe he used a warm fermentation, but a longer, colder lagering time. And again, you know, it's I imagine it is a bit confusing for new lager brewers and hearing all these different, you know, correct ways to do it. But it really depends on understanding, you know, the yeast, how they work, and the taste of the beer. And as you say, you know, you know, you can do it this way, but you got to be aware of the sulfur. You can do it the other way, but you got to be aware of, you know, and needing it to temperature rise. And, you know, there's, many ways to skin the cat.
Sure. Is there any benefit, Dennis is asking, is there any benefit to first wort hop these beers?
Hotly debated topic. I always first wort hop because I can, you know. I don't know that I've never done a side-by-side to say that there's a definite difference. I think there have been some side-by-sides, and I can't think I don't remember hearing that they were conclusive one way or another.
Yeah, you know, my experience with first wort hopping is it really just essentially adds to the bittering and nothing to the aroma. You know, the Germans, the traditional Germans back in the day, they weren't looking for any flavor whatsoever from the hops. They just wanted pure, clean bitterness. And adding the hops early tend to blow off a lot more of those aromatics and flavor compounds, I think. And I think that's really, you know, the general concept they were going for back then.
Yeah. They said they got a smoother beer or a smoother hop character. Well, maybe that meant, you know, less hop flavor. Right. You know, it depends on what you're looking for.
It certainly doesn't hurt to do it.
Yeah.
I think if you enjoy it, I would say go for it. That's the beauty of home brewing. Let's see here. Let's take another real short break. And when we come back, we've got a question from Jimmy about his lack of being able to chill. We'll be back right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking Oktoberfest and how to brew great Oktoberfests and lagers and things like that because tis the season. Let's see. Jimmy was asking, with my setup, I can only chill down to 62 to 64 in the kettle. Would it be better to pitch the yeast and then continue chilling in fermentation fridge or put it in the fridge and wait to pitch until it hits the desired, example, 50 or 52 Fahrenheit desired fermentation temperature?
I always chill then pitch.
I do too. The reason being, you know, you put the yeast in there and you're asking them to go to work and then they feel the cooling and getting colder and colder. You know,
yeah.
it could be a problem. I know people who have done it and the beer turned out pretty good. And I know, you know, there's some advice out there to let the yeast get going at that temperature and then chill it down, which makes like zero sense to me because a lot of the flavor you're developing is developing at that initial pitching temperature. Yeah. So, you know, fermenting later on at a lower temperature, I don't think really helps. So what I did when I struggled to get the temperature down, I would put the whole carboy in the fridge and, you know, pitch the next day or whatever.
Yeah.
When the temperature was correct. But what I would urge you to try, with your setup, you can only chill down to 62, 64. If you have like a copper, coil that you're using and tap water, you might get yourself an inexpensive pump, you know, a sump pump or something like that. And then put it in a bucket of ice water, put some ice in there and then use that. And you can even recirculate that. You know, you can use hose water to start, get yourself down to 62, 64, and then switch to your bucket of ice water. And that will take it down the rest of the way. That, along with whirlpooling the wort, you can get down to, very cold. I was able to get my wort down into the 40s, no problem with that. And it just takes a bit of ice and, inexpensive pump that can just pump some water, cheap little aquarium pumps or sump pumps.
Yeah. Yeah. I recommend waiting, you know, I mean, I can only chill down to about 80 degrees here in Southern California. So I will get the wort made. I'll put it in the fermenter. Everything's nice and sanitized. Then I put it in the fermentation fridge overnight. The next day it's down to my, you know, 65 or 55 in the case of lagers, you know, pitching temp. And then I'll aerate and pitch my yeast. I'm doing it that way because it's convenient. It's one less thing I have to worry about on brew day. I know my sanitation is good. I don't have any worries about, you know, needing to get it started sooner to get the yeast to, you know, dominate the ferment, you know, the environment. No, my sanitation was good. I don't have any worries about letting it sit overnight. And then I just pitch the next day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ted is asking, this is referring back to, I was talking about lowering the temperature of the beer, slowly. He says, so what happens if you cold crash from 50 degrees down to 36 degrees? Would letting it lager longer help any off flavors? I just did this with mine a couple of weeks ago. Should I be worried? Yeah, Ted, just pour the whole thing out. Don't even wait. Just dump it. It'll be fine. But what happens is when you quickly crash yeast, I think I mentioned this in the yeast book, when you quickly crash yeast, they tend to express more of these compounds, which can become fruity esters. So one of the reasons you slowly take a lager down is so that they don't express these compounds. They utilize them in different ways in preparing themselves to go to sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why you take it down very slowly. And this is one of the things that I missed when I was, you know, initially I'm just like, makes no sense. You know, you're not going to have yeast activity below 40. You know, why are people worrying about this whole thing and slowly bringing them down? And then I learned that, yeah, it does make a difference. And I think that the paper I saw talked about like a 30 to 50% or 50% increase in fruitiness of a beer if you crash it cold versus take it down slowly. So we, you know, here at Heretic, we spend the time to take it down cold slowly. It's more work, more time, but it definitely seems to make a difference. So
yeah,
I don't think your beer is ruined, Ted, but you know, next time you brew one, you might want to try that technique and see if you get better results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The workshop mentioned that too. They all slow cooled. Mm-hmm. It was, in other words, a controlled cooling to take it from, you know, end of fermentation down to lagering.
Yeah, we've been talking about that for so many years. I think, you know, it's just become one of those things. Will is asking, what's your opinion using a yeast like Quebec Oslo in an Oktoberfest?
So using a Quebec yeast at low temperatures as opposed to their normal high temperatures to suppress esters and brew a more lager character type beer. Low temperature for quake is, you know, somewhere in the, you know, 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit range, compared to their normal temperatures of say 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Anytime you use a different yeast, it's going to be a different beer. So, you know, but again, if you want to try it that way and take advantage of Kike's unique properties when it comes to fermentation, do it. I think you're going to get a different tasting Oktoberfest, but
it'll be beer.
Yeah, it'll be beer. It may be a perfectly decent tasting beer. And it may be even a decent interpretation of the Oktoberfest style. You know, I guess
I have my doubts.
Yeah.
I must say.
Yeah. It's going to be different.
It's not going to taste Oktoberfest-y. I think it's going to taste,
right,
you know.
Yeah. Quake likes warm temperatures. It likes lots of yeast nutrient. In other words, high fan load. If you try to stress it and bring it down to cooler temperatures, you're probably going to get, you won't get the fusel alcohol or phenolic character that you experience with some yeast under stress. But I think you're going to get a different ester character that's going to taste, well, very un-Oktoberfest-like, really.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's the issue, I think. You know, we talked about high pressure brewing and things like that, how, you know, it's just not the same as, you know, just a well fermented lager under, you know, normal conditions.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people are always trying to find ways to kind of game the system as far as temperature control or, you know, yeast pitching or things like that. And I would just urge people to, you know, invest in, you know, the ability to control a fridge or something like that, so you get proper temperature control. It's well worth it. I mean, the results are amazing when you do, and especially in lagers, you can, you know, make just these stunning lagers and lagers that are hard to get fresh, you know? So I would say it's definitely worth the effort. Willow was saying, would you then get a benefit of lagering it? I think you get a benefit from lagering, whether or not, you know, if it's cold enough, the yeast aren't active. So yeast aren't really adding anything to it. But yes, I mean, lagering, just a period of cold stabilization, maturation happens. And so I think most beers benefit from a cold period of rest.
Yeah, it may be a purely physical thing, depending on the yeast and the beer. You know, just dropping of the haze, dropping of all the suspended yeast, you know, from that extended lagering time. Again, this depends on the particular yeast strain and the whole fermentation regimen that it's gone through. But yeah, lagering will improve the beer probably.
Yep. Another fine show. Thanks for joining us. If you're listening live, stay tuned. We're going to have another episode coming immediately following this. Make sure to check out our good friends at Brew Chatter in Reno, Sparks. Good folks, great homebrew shop, brewchatter.com. They got all sorts of great ingredients. They're wonderful people with a great knowledge of brewing and how to improve your brewing. So check them out. Good friends of mine. I enjoy going there as often as I can. Hope to see you there soon. So check that out. And thank you for your support. And Brew Strong, everyone.
Brew Strong.